This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is an Israeli journalist, Hillel Halkin. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Halkin is visiting from Israel and is a guest of the program at the University of Illinois, the Program for Jewish Culture and Society, whose director is also with us in the studio, Professor Michael Shapiro. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you both here. Hillel, you've been here for a week at the University of Illinois, and you're going to be here another week and giving another two or three lectures on campus. How have you been received?
Very grandly, with such hospitality that I'm just yearning for a few minutes of solitude here and there, because I'm constantly being wined and dined and entertained and overworked.
Ah, well, this next hour is easy because you don't have to lecture.
Right.
We're talking about American churches and Israel, American Christian churches. There seems to be quite a diversity of reaction to Israel, to Zionism, from American Christians. Now, you yourself were born here in New York, you were telling me.
That's right.
And you've been in Israel, however, since when?
Since 1970.
Since 1970. Yeah. And you write for a New York newspaper, The Sun.
I write for several places, but I have a weekly political commentary from Israel column in the New York Sun, which is a small... I guess you could call it neocon New York Daily.
And as well, does that same column appear in the Jerusalem Post?
No, the column that I write twice a month in the Jerusalem Post is totally different.
It's different.
It has actually a different, somewhat different character.
But you've continued your interest in United States Christian reaction to Israel.
Well, you can't, I think, be a thinking Israeli and not care about United States Christian reaction towards Israel, because the United States itself is such a crucial player for Israel in the international scene. And, the Christian community in the United States has not such a small say, I think, in United States government policy.
But it's not one voice. It's several voices.
Well, from the distance of Israel, it seems to be more or less two voices. There actually may be many more, but I'm not sure that I'm capable from that distance of picking up all the nuances.
So what are the two loudest Christian voices that you hear all the way in Israel?
From what I hear in Israel, there's on the one hand the evangelical voice, which is extremely pro-Israel. I mean, sometimes from my perspective as a Jew, astoundingly pro-Israel. And on the other hand, there seems to be the voice of what I guess you might call the liberal northern establishment churches, such as the Presbyterians or the Anglicans, Unitarians, who seem to be increasingly anti-Israel, to the point that several of them have in recent years or in this past year advocated boycotts of Israel, of Israeli goods, disinvestment from Israel. Those two opposites, very striking.
From the perspective in Israel of you as a writer, you're now an Israeli citizen, right?
Well, actually, I have
dual citizenship,
but yes, I've been an Israeli citizen for many years. Uh-huh. I've served in the Israeli army, and I pay taxes in Israel, sure.
Are there Christian voices in Israel that are heard much?
No, I don't think so. The Christian community in Israel is very small. Most of it is in the Arab sector, but the Arab Christian community is also small, and although I'm not sure that it's dwindling in absolute terms, but relatively speaking, it's growing smaller in proportion not only to the Israeli Jewish community, but to the Arab Muslim community, which has a far higher birth rate and a far lower rate of immigration.
Sure. When you went to Israel in 1970, what was the impression then you had of Christian voices in the U.S. in relation to Israel?
Well, I'm not sure I remember that impression, and I'm not sure there was such an impression, uh-huh. because I think that in 1970, the Christian community on both sides was far less vocal and probably far less active in relation to Israel than it has become since. I think that you know, on the whole, neither the enthusiastic support for Israel that you find among evangelicals nor the extremely critical attitude that you find among some of the more liberal churches existed in 1970, as far as I remember.
Hmm. With the growth of evangelical political power in this country, of evangelical Christians, mm-hmm. and their influence on national politics, have you seen a change in official U.S. government policy to Israel?
Well, you know, it's very hard for me to say, and again, I have to emphasize that I'm not an insider in terms of understanding America anymore. But I've heard it said, and it seems plausible, that it may just not be an accident that George Bush, who, in my opinion, is the most pro-Israel president that has ever been in the White House in Washington, is also an evangelical Christian, or at least is on the verge or on the fringes of evangelical Christianity. This may not be a coincidence.
Tell us some of the signs of Bush's pro-Israeli stance.
Well, you know, there's never really been an anti-Israel president. And I think certainly since the creation of Israel in 1948, there's been on the whole, a gradual warming of presidential attitudes toward Israel. The first presidents, Truman, Eisenhower, even Kennedy, although not anti-Israel by any means, were not overtly or strongly pro-Israel. They really were more neutral. Starting with Lyndon Johnson, I think you begin to get more and more of a pro-Israel tone in the White House. It tends to strengthen with Democrats and then weaken with Republicans. I mean, with Nixon was not, I think, terribly pro-Israel. If it hadn't been for Bush, I might very well have said that Bill Clinton was the most pro-Israel president ever in the White House.
More than Reagan?
No, maybe not more than Reagan. Except that Clinton, I think, seemed to have more of an emotional attitude towards Israel than Reagan. I mean, Clinton seemed very close, for instance, to Yitzhak Rabin, who seemed genuinely emotionally shocked by Rabin's assassination. But Clinton in some ways pales next to Bush. You know, Clinton was the man who invited Yasser Arafat into the White House and made every attempt to be as friendly with Arafat and with the Palestinian organizations that some overtly or covertly supported anti-Israel terror, as he was friendly with Rabin. Bush is the man who at one point simply refused to talk to Arafat anymore. To me, that's a dramatic difference.
Mm-hmm. When Camp David happened and didn't progress, mm-hmm. what was the impression in Israel about that?
Well, it depends what part of the political spectrum you were coming from.
And which part are you coming from?
Well, I've always liked to think of myself as kind of middle of the road in terms of Israeli politics. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I was very relieved when Camp David failed because mm-hmm. I thought Israel was on the verge of making too many concessions mm-hmm. and making the wrong concessions. And I was actually happy to see the Camp David talks not succeed. I think it could have been disastrous for Israel if they had succeeded.
And do you still feel the same way?
More so, even.
More so. Even after Hamas had the election victories recently?
On the contrary. Suppose that Israel had signed the Camp David Accords, had made all the concessions that the Camp David Accords had called for, had made all the withdrawals, and then Hamas had come to power, which seems to me not at all unlikely. Hmm. Where would Israel be then?
Hmm. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with a guest from Israel, a Israeli journalist who writes a column for the Jerusalem Post and also for the New York Sun. He's an author and a translator, translating Hebrew to English and Yiddish to English. Hillel Halkin is at the university campus for the next week. He's been here a week and will be here another week. He'll be giving three talks tomorrow at Levis Center. That's Monday, February 27 in the music room. He'll also be lecturing Thursday, March 2nd in the same location, and then March 6th also at Levis. And tell our listeners what you'll be talking about. Let's see, on the topic for tomorrow is Yehuda Halevi.
Yeah, I'm giving a series of three lectures on a very interesting medieval Hebrew poet who is very, very well known in Jewish tradition and in Hebrew literature, Yehuda Halevi, whom I'm also writing a small book on as part of a series that a New York publisher is putting out on renowned Jews in history.
And then on Thursday, you're looking at modern Israeli literature.
Right.
And that'll be 7:30 on Thursday, March 2nd. And then the following Monday, March 6th, I guess will be your last talk here on
campus.
Right,
that will be the third of the series.
Okay. Very good. Those are all free talks. And let me tell listeners that if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment to our guest today, do give us a call. This is a live call-in program every Sunday afternoon here on WILL AM 580. Anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And in Champaign-Urbana, there are several local lines that you can access by punching in 333-9455. And I see we've already got a caller on one of our local lines. Let's go to that call. Line number one, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you for the program. I noticed that your guest mentioned that some of the Protestant denominations in the U.S. have passed resolutions or policies of, he referred to it as boycotting Israel. And I just wanted to point out that many people might not realize if they don't follow these things closely, that but most of these churches have been talking about and pursuing is really a selective disinvestment policy. It's not really boycotting Israel. These are policies targeted against the policies of occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. For example, the Anglicans in Britain have just passed a selective divestment policy, particularly aimed at Caterpillar, based in Peoria, which produces and sells the bulldozers that are used to demolish Palestinian homes. So I think that's an important distinction. You might be against both and regard them both as anathema, but you know, for many people, that would be an important distinction. It's not against Israel per se. It's against particular policies of the Israeli government.
Response?
I must say, perhaps I'm a little obtuse, but I don't quite understand that distinction. If I were to say to you that I think you're a bad driver, so I'm going to refuse to sell you gasoline, and I'm going to make sure that no gas station in Champaign-Urbana sells you gasoline, but that I really have nothing against you personally and don't take this as a boycott of you, I'm not sure that you would consider it that. And then if I said not only that, I'll make sure that no car dealer sells you a car either because I think you're a bad driver. But honestly, you have to understand I have nothing against you personally. You might wonder whether that's really the case.
So when our caller makes a distinction between the divestment because of certain policies, do you think that that kind of pressure is a legitimate pressure if someone actually disagrees with those policies?
I think all pressure is legitimate pressure as long as it's not violent. I'm not saying that these churches do not have the right to boycott Israel or to disinvest in Israel. I'm just saying that I think that they are badly mistaken. I think that they, in some cases, are coming dangerously close in their double standards that they're using for Israel vis-a-vis other countries. They're coming dangerously close to anti-Semitism. I think that in many ways they're declaring themselves to be my enemy, but that they have a legitimate legal right to behave that way, I have no doubt.
So when you talk about these religious groups, in this case Protestant churches, who are taking these stands, you really think that they are your enemy because?
Because they're judging me as a Jew, that is personifying myself as the Jewish state. They're judging me differently from the way they judge non-Jews. I haven't heard any of these Protestant churches calling for disinvestment from Russia, even though what Russia is doing in Chechnya is far worse by any standard, far, far, far worse than anything Israel can be accused of doing in the West Bank. I haven't heard them call for disinvesting from in China, even though what the Chinese are doing in their wholesale extermination of Tibetan culture goes infinitely beyond anything Israel is doing to the Palestinians. So they're exerting a double standard. They're judging a Jewish state differently from their way they're judging non-Jewish states, and differently for the worse. The only reason I can think that they are doing this is because it is a Jewish state. And if this is the only reason that they are doing it, then they are, as I said, coming dangerously close to being anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I've already passed over that line.
Are the Christian churches, which are evangelical and completely in support of Israel and Israeli policies, are they coming close to being anti-Palestinian?
They may be. Mm-hmm. They may be. Yes, if I were a Palestinian, I would no doubt feel that.
Uh-huh. What is your personal view as an Israeli citizen in terms of, say, two-state solution?
I think a two-state solution, in theory, is perfectly reasonable. I, as an Israeli, have never really felt that Israel could retain all of the Palestinian territories. Mm-hmm. I would say that this is not a question of principle. If I thought that it were possible for Israel to annex all of what Israelis call Judea and Samaria and Palestinians call the West Bank, if I thought it were possible for Israel to annex these territories and grant full citizenship and full rights to all the Palestinians living in them, and nevertheless survive as a Jewish state with a predominantly Jewish character, I would be very tempted to say, yes, let's do it. As a Jew, I feel that these territories are mine as much as they are a Palestinian's. I have never felt that the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, did not belong to me. It belongs to the Palestinians, too. But the reason that I have no doubt that Israel has to leave most of these territories is not one of rights or of theoretical things. It's a practical one. I think Israel cannot annex these territories and give their inhabitants full rights, because then the demographic balance of Jews and Arabs will have so changed in Israel that it will no longer be a Jewish state. And I'm not prepared to rule over people who do not have full rights. I mean, that seems to be a moral question. Yeah.
And what about Gaza?
Well, I would say the same thing holds true for Gaza. At the same time, I would say that I see no sacred need on the Palestinians' part for a state. Or I would say that, on the other hand, I think the Palestinians already have a state in the form of Jordan, which is the country next door and which has something like a 70% Palestinian population. And, there are 21 Arab states in the world today. Three or four of them, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, are part of the same culture area as Palestine. Those are not very different linguistically in terms of religious life, culturally, from the Palestinian world. I don't see that there's any intrinsic need why there has to be one more such state. So if the Palestinians were simply to take the West Bank and even Gaza and join up with Jordan and have a much larger entity as a result, I think that would more than meet their aspirations.
We have another caller waiting on our local line. That's 333-9455 for others who would like to call and join this conversation. If you're outside of Champaign-Urbana, the toll-free line is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to line number one. Go ahead, please.
I would just comment, a couple of comments about the divestment issue that some of the churches are asking for. Was it the same as being anti-white when they were asking to divest from South Africa? And also, the evangelicals who are supporting Israel, aren't they supporting Israel because when salvation comes or Armageddon comes, Israel is going to be destroyed and they will go to heaven? So, I mean, there are lots of crazy things going on out there. I think part of the issue may be what should be done for the Palestinians? Do they deserve a state, or does Israel, how does Israel see the Palestine issue? Thank you.
Well, I think the comparison of Israel with South Africa, which is, of course, commonly made by in anti-Israel circles today, is invidious and totally unjustified. In the first place, I never remember that blacks in South Africa claiming or wanting at any point in their history to destroy the white population of the country and drive it into the sea, as has been the case traditionally with Arab attitudes toward Israel until at least fairly recently. It's also not the case that there's never been, and there to this day is no such thing as physical apartheid in Israel. And there never has been. Although there is certainly in many ways discrimination against both Israeli-Palestinians who have full democratic rights on paper but are sometimes denied them in practice. And then you have the Palestinian population in the West Bank, which in many ways does suffer from severe restrictions. This has nothing to do with racism, as was the case in South Africa. Israelis have never had the slightest problem about eating with Arabs, about socializing with Arabs, about mixing with Arabs, about being with Arabs, about being treated in hospitals by Arabs or treating Arabs in their hospitals or whatever. So that the Israeli problem with Palestinians, with Arabs, has never been a racist problem. It's been a political problem, and it's been a political problem with people who have refused to recognize Israel's existence in many cases, as does the party that just won the recent Palestinian elections. So that I just don't think there's any comparison to be made with South Africa. There was a second part to the question, which had to do with evangelicals. I don't care if the evangelicals, the evangelicals that I know are not imminently waiting for Israel's destruction. But, if the evangelicals support me because they think one day I'll become, a Christian and return to my ancient Jewish Christian roots as they see it, that's their problem. I don't see that affects my welfare at the moment. And if they're willing, for whatever reasons, to support Israel, which is in many ways a country that does not have a great amount of support in the world today because it's a tiny little country surrounded by very large enemies who command much greater influence and much greater power and wealth in the world, I'll take that support where I can get it.
We have another caller again on our local line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest Hillel Halkin. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you. There's a lot been said here that I disagree with, but let me focus on just a couple of things. The idea that there isn't sort of a Bantustan arrangement happening even more than ever is really ludicrous with the wall, the fence, the barrier. Whatever you want to call it, the fact that you can say that you see no racism doesn't imply that people like the former Koch party, which was ruled to be illegal, but it still has Molodet is still into transfer, and it's a fairly racist stance, it seems to me. I think it's extremely important that that the churches are doing what they're doing, and to paint it with anti-Semitism is the shallowest tactic and the most predictable one. But I actually have something about the evangelicals. Reverend Don Wagner, who is from Chicago, who is an evangelical who spoke at the Y some time ago, has a short little monogram called All in the Name of the Bible that chronicles a lot of what the Christian Zionists espouse, and they actually want to accelerate the end time. So contrary to what you say about wanting to convert Jews, they actually want to just fulfill the prophecy and bring on Armageddon, the end of the world. So it's not quite as mild as you put it. One thing that I learned from Reverend Wagner was that Christian Zionism actually predates Herzl's Zionism in Europe, at least as far as the original statement that was made in Vienna about a very secular kind of Zionism. There was actually a meeting in Ohio, I think, that called for restoring the Jews to the land of Palestine in something like 1893. So anyway, I beg to differ, and I'll listen.
Thank you for the call.
Well, let me take those points you made one by one. You mentioned two Israeli parties, Kach, not Kach, as you say, but Kach and Moledet. Moledet, which is the larger of the two, I think in the last elections, and they will not necessarily do better in the next elections, this extreme right-wing party, as you rightly called it, received something like three seats in a 120-member Knesset, which means that less than 3% of Israelis, of your racist anti-Palestinian Israelis, voted for the extreme anti-Palestinian party. Hamas, which has spent much of the last 10 years blowing up buses and cafes and restaurants and markets in Israel and killing Israelis, including some whom I have known, received 45% of the vote in the last Palestinian election. So if you're talking about Israeli attitudes towards Palestinians and Palestinian attitudes towards Israel, I think those figures speak very eloquently for themselves. You know, the fence or the wall, as you put it, it's actually both, although it's much more of a fence because in the rural areas that it largely runs through, it is a fence. It's a chain-link fence that doesn't look that different from a cattle fence. Yeah, that fence has been very, very restrictive to Palestinians and has caused them many hardships, just as the roadblocks caused them many hardships and the checkpoints caused them many hardships. But it saved many Israeli lives, just as the checkpoints and the roadblocks do, just as a week doesn't go by in which those same Palestinians who have to wait sometimes hours at a roadblock, and I understand their frustration, but every other day one of those frustrated thousands, is found with a bomb on him. And that bomb is meant for me, for my children, for my wife, for my family. And if you ask me, what do I prefer to do, to inconvenience Palestinians with a fence or a roadblock, or to see my friends or neighbors or family blown up by a Palestinian bomb? My answer is definitely I'd rather inconvenience them.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is an Israeli author, translator, and journalist, Hillel Halkin. He's here at the University of Illinois campus for 2 weeks as a guest of the center headed by Michael Shapiro, the Program of Jewish Culture and Society. And Michael also has joined us in the studio today. People who would like to meet Mr. Halkin in person, hear him lecture, are invited Monday, tomorrow, the 27th, to Levis Center, the music room. The same place also on Thursday at 7:30, March 2nd, and also the following Monday, March 6th. You'll be talking about an Israeli medieval poet, you said.
Right.
We're about halfway through our program. Let me take just a moment to let listeners know who's coming up in future Keeping the Faith discussions. You're always welcome to call and make comments on for any of our guests. Next week, our guest will be Lisha Banks, who will be talking about eliminating racism and empowering women, the mission of the YWCA in the United States. On March 12, our guest will be Hassan Jabbar. He'll be talking about the life of the Prophet Muhammad. Those are some of our guests coming up in the weeks ahead here on Keeping the Faith. Support for these programs is provided in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest religious institution at this campus. It was started by students back in 1873. We're open to people of any faith or of no faith. People, students who want to be involved in social action and community service have found the Y a friendly and helpful place for many decades. We also have programs for the community, for faculty and staff of the university, as well as students. One of our programs is a lecture series on Tuesday called Know Your University. Last Tuesday, President B. Joseph White of the University of Illinois spoke about his plans for the future. This coming Tuesday at noon, Lauren Taylor, who's President and CEO of the University of Illinois Alumni Association, will be talking about the almost 400,000 living graduates of the university and what the Alumni Association provides for them. That talk will be at the Y, 1001 South Wright Street, noon this Tuesday, February 28th. This Friday on March 3rd, also at noon at the Y, part of the Friday Forum series speaking about democracy at risk, our guest will be Erica Miners, professor of education and women's studies at Northeastern Illinois University. She'll be talking about schools, jails, and the production of public enemies, the right to be hostile. That's Erica Miners this Friday at the Y, March 3 at noon. Well, let's get back to our guest today. Hillel Halkin is our guest, and Michael Shapiro is also in the studio. We have a couple people waiting. Let's go to line number one. Go ahead, please. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Hello. Possibly I didn't understand, but are you calling the wall, which parts of it, much of it is 20 feet high, a fence?
Yeah, I am saying that most of the wall, which runs through rural countryside, not only I'm calling it a fence, it is a fence. If you were to see it, you would see that it is a fence. It is not 20 feet high. It is perhaps 8 feet high, or maybe at the most 10 feet high. I've been there. I've been along stretches of it. Where it runs through urban areas, it is both much higher, and in these urban areas, such as parts of Jerusalem, or else where Israeli roads run very close to Palestinian houses on the other side, yes, there it is, a wall, and it's a wall for a very simple reason. Because you can shoot through a fence, and you cannot shoot through a concrete wall. And where Palestinian houses come very, very close to the barrier, and shots can be fired at Israelis through a fence, it turns into a wall. It's that simple.
Thank you.
And we have another caller waiting on line number two. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm in late, so you might have covered this. But I was wondering if you could talk a little about some of the churches involved in the divestment process. I know the Anglican Church, which has some movements in that direction, has a strong connection with Anglican churches in Jerusalem and in other areas where the heads of the church are pro-Palestinian, or actually are Palestinian and are politically connected to the Palestinian movement. And maybe you could talk a little about that whole dynamic with the various churches in Jerusalem. And also, I know the Presbyterian Church, which is one of the churches in the United States that was working with the divestment, also has issues with the Jewish community in terms of churches which are made out to be sort of pseudo-synagogues. And I know Michael is somewhat involved in that and can probably speak more to that.
Maybe Michael would like to answer.
Well, I can... as a matter of fact, the local Jewish community had a meeting with members of the local Presbyterian community last year or so, and discussed both of these issues. At the time, the Presbyterian National Movement was supporting a church in Philadelphia, which seemed to be really a kind of Jews for Jesus operation that was pretending to be Jewish, but in fact it was Christian. And since then, the Presbyterian Church has pulled the plug on that church in Philadelphia. They no longer support it. So I think that issue is off the table. We also discussed with the representatives of the five Presbyterian churches, the local Jewish community, the issue of disinvestment from companies like Caterpillar. And I can't say we came to any conclusion, but I did learn a lot about this whole process. One of the things I learned is that the resolution that did pass at the National Movement was somewhat controversial, more than somewhat. It was very controversial, and that there are many local churches in various regions and communities like ours where many members, maybe even a majority of members, really didn't support it. But it was passed by delegates at a national meeting, and the one of the issues that seem to promote the passage of that disinvestment policy, which didn't come in right away. It was going to – they would look at it after a couple of years. It was really rather mild when you think about it. But nevertheless, it has great symbolic force because it is a way of delegitimizing Israel and invoking a double standard. But the Presbyterians have a long history of missions on the West Bank, and life is difficult for Palestinians and sometimes very painful. And so they were trying, I think, responding to that pain and thought that perhaps this would be a way to do it. Now, I think this issue is still up for grabs in the Presbyterian National Church, and I'm not quite sure where it is at the moment. But the others I'm not familiar with.
Thank you for the question. We have a – do you want to respond to that at all?
No, because I'm really not familiar with internal church politics in the United States.
We do have another caller waiting on local line number 3. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead.
Yes. I want to ask one question. I heard the program. My question is, do you think good fences make good neighbors? That was a quote from Robert Frost. I'll hang up and listen to your response. Do you think good neighbors make fences?
I would much have preferred this fence not to go up if it weren't necessary. I don't like fences very much, and I certainly don't like them when they run through countries. I would much prefer that Palestinians and Israelis live in one geographical expanse without fences between them and without walls between them and with the ability to move freely from one to the other. And I still would hope that someday that would be achievable in Israel and Palestine. Fences or walls that go up can come down one day. We've seen that with the Berlin Wall, and I hope one day we'll see that with the security barrier on the West Bank. But unfortunately, I think that barrier was necessary. I think that barrier had to be put up because simply too many Israelis were being the victims of horrendous Palestinian terror attacks that could not be sufficiently stopped in other ways. And I think a fence, for all its ugliness and for all its the dislocation that it causes, is not an act of violence. A fence does not wound anyone the way bombing or shooting or killing does, and I would rather have a fence than have to either be bombed myself or bomb somebody else.
About 2 years ago on this campus, there was an attempt by Muslims, Christians, and Jews to take a group of students to the Holy Land and see sites considered sacred by all three of those major religions. And it happened that there was a attack in Israel with bombing and killing at the start of that semester that we hoped to get people to sign up for this this interfaith trip, this interfaith journey. And as a result, it was impossible to do, and plus the university at that time had Israel on its list of places that it would not encourage students to go to. That's changed. But how safe is it now, given the violence, for people to visit Israel?
Well, I think it's always been pretty safe for people to visit Israel. I think even at the height of the violence of the Second Intifada, it was pretty safe for people to visit Israel. And I think Israelis who lived those years of violence day by day and often did, you know, find themselves not personally generally exposed to bombings, but knew of people or certainly knew of places that were being bombed. Nevertheless, found it almost comical in a way how frightened people were of coming to Israel in those years, not only because, you know, bombs were not the greatest cause of accident of non-illness related deaths in Israel in those years. Anyway, your chances in the worst years of the Intifada of getting killed in a traffic accident in Israel were always higher than of getting killed by a bombing. And to tell you the truth, they're high. Your chances of getting killed in a traffic accident in the United States were higher than those of being killed in a bombing in Israel in the worst years, which never would have, you know, kept most Americans from getting into a car and driving on an American highway. So today I would say that that's even more the case. But Israel, apart from the bombs, Israel is an extremely safe country. There's not a neighborhood of a city in Israel that I would really be afraid, let's say, of my daughter is walking in at any hour of the night. Hmm. Of how many American cities can you say that? Mm-hmm. Israel is, generally speaking, a very safe country. We, to this day, will leave our house in the town we live in and go away for a day and not lock the door. And sometimes we'll go for a week because we forgot to lock the door because we're not in the habit of it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that impelled me to be a host for this program when I started it about 7 years ago now was the belief that much of the conflict in the world did come from a religious base and religious misunderstandings. And that increasing the opportunity for people to learn about folks of other religious traditions would be a help, maybe grandiose, but thinking maybe even eventually helping, doing something positive toward world peace. What impels you to be a journalist and to communicate about these issues?
Well, to be frank, what most impels me to be a journalist is the need to make a living. You know, I would relate to your first comment, which is often, I mean, it's something you often hear, how religion causes people to fight all the time. I'm not sure the truth of that isn't the opposite. You don't really have to reverse the proposition and say that it's because people need to fight all the time that they have different religions, because the fact is that if people don't fight over religion historically, they'll find plenty of other things to fight about. I mean, it seems to me that there's a certain aggressive human need to fight, and religion is simply a pretext for it in many cases. As I say, when religion isn't the pretext, something else is found.
What do you think might lead to peace in Israel?
Well, I think what might lead to at least a de facto peace in Israel, a peace of some kind on the ground, if not to a formal and complete peace, is a situation where Palestinians are relieved of the Israeli military occupation, so that either the small number of them that is incorporated into territory in which Israel remains will be given full citizenship rights, just as all Israeli Arabs have today, and the largest number will simply be freed of Israeli rule entirely, and in which Israel, on the one hand, will be strong enough and continue to be strong enough to defend itself against any Arab dream of destroying it, and which, on the other hand, the Palestinians will be able to lead sufficiently prosperous and pleasant lives that even if they don't get all their country back, all of it, or even if they don't have all their aspirations fulfilled, they'll nevertheless find the situation tolerable and livable.
We're down to the last quarter or so of this program. Let me give the phone numbers one more time in case listeners would like to speak with our guest, Hillel Halkin. You can make a comment or ask a question by punching in 1-800-222-9455. And that's true also for listeners on the Internet at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Anywhere in the continental U.S., you may use that 800 number, that toll-free number, to call us. In Champaign-Urbana, there are several lines available if you punch in 333-9455. All we ask is that you try to keep your questions relatively short to make room for others who may also want to make a comment or ask a question. Getting back to our guest on the issue of the Christian church's reaction to Israel, we haven't spent much time talking about the evangelical Christians who are totally pro-Israel at this time for various reasons. We've had a caller or two who've speculated on what some of those real reasons or what that theology leads them to. You grew up as a Jew in this country.
Right.
Did you have any contact with evangelical Christians? Were you ever tried to be?
No. As a matter of fact, it may surprise you to hear that the first real evangelical Christians whom I ever have met, I met this week in Champaign.
Really?
And I have never personally known evangelicals before. My guess is that the great majority of American Jews have never met evangelicals in their life, which is, I think, one reason they often tend to demonize them or to think of them in extreme stereotypes. Hmm.
We have another caller waiting on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Yes, go right ahead. Line number one.
Okay. Could you paint a picture for me as to who or what nations in the world do not support Israel's right to be a nation? And secondly, could you comment on your perception of those folks involved in the what was called the Christian peacemaker teams in your country? I'll hang up now.
As for those countries, the first part of your question, I think they're on the one hand countries which vociferously deny Israel's right to exist and even speak of the need to exterminate it, such as Iran is now doing constantly, and the Iranian prime minister has done only again and again in recent days and weeks. This, mind you, is a country that is now trying to acquire atomic weapons that actually could destroy Israel. I'm not sure at the moment if there are any other Arab countries or governments that are calling for Israel's destruction in that sense. I think there probably aren't. There are certain large and vociferous publics in Arab states that are doing so. And Hamas, of course, which have just won the Palestinian elections and will now be head of the Palestinian Authority, will run that country or that entity, has continually and recalled for Israel's destruction and has refused even now to say that it will cease to call for Israel's destruction. Beyond that, you have many, many countries in the world which, although they may not be actively calling for Israel's destruction, have refused to recognize it and refused to conduct diplomatic relations with it. This includes not only many Arab countries such as Syria, Libya, Sudan, Yemen, one could go on. It includes many non-Arab Muslim countries. Indonesia, which is a country of over 100 million people, is one example. Pakistan is another. Bangladesh is yet another. So there are many, many countries in this world that have not acknowledged Israel's right to exist in terms of recognizing it and recognizing it diplomatically. Maybe someone will remind me what the second part of the question was.
Christian peacemaking teams.
Well, I don't know a great deal about that. I do think that most of the Christian peacemaking teams that have come to Israel have, at least from my perspective, have come with a pro-Palestinian and anti-Israeli bias. Most of them have operated entirely in the Palestinian territories. And, you know, I don't know exactly of what their Christianity consists. I just see them as being players in a political game and being it on the Palestinian side, which, of course, is their privilege. But it doesn't give me any particular respect for them. And I don't see how their Christianity is coming to play here particularly.
Currently, there is a Christian peacemaking team that's been captured and is being held hostage in Iraq with the threat of death if America doesn't release all Iraqi prisoners.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed a month or two ago a representative of one of the Christian peacemaking teams who'd been in Iraq for the last 3 years for 4 or 5 months. And he seemed, a man from Indiana, he seemed very concerned that there be peace and tried to be very neutral between, even though he was an American, mm-hmm. to try to be very neutral between the Iraqi people and the U.S. soldiers. And, and the various perspectives there. I don't know. I have not interviewed.
It's always struck me that the kind of approach to making peace that you have to spread goodwill and get people to understand each other, and then peace breaks out, is really a mistaken perception of how things work in a real world. In a real world, it tends to work precisely the opposite. You don't first create goodwill and then use that to solve political problems. You first solve the political problems, and their solution creates goodwill. I often use, when I speak about this, I point to the example of the American South and segregation. You know, you could have had goodwill meetings between blacks and whites and group dynamic sessions and God knows what from here to eternity in the American South, and segregation would have gone right on, and the predominant attitudes of whites towards blacks in the South would have not have changed one whit, and that could have gone on another 100 years. When the Supreme Court ruled, outlawed school segregation, and then a series of political acts in the United States Congress entirely outlawed Jim Crow and outlawed segregation in the South and politically put an end to segregation, attitudes started to change wholesale in the South because people had to accommodate themselves to the political facts. And I think that's the way it always works. You're not going to get peace in the Middle East by getting Jews and Arabs to love each other first, or even to like each other, or even to understand each other. You're going to get peace in the Middle East, or something like it, or approximating it, by politically creating the conditions that will lead to a cessation of violence and warfare. Once that happens, people will begin to like each other more.
And do you see that? Do you have any vision of that actually happening in the near future?
Well, as I tried to say in answer to one of your previous questions, I do have a certain optimism that if Israel can continue with the process of unilateral withdrawal that it began in Gaza and leave most of the Palestinian territories, withdrawing to borders that it considers defensible demographically and politically and even morally defensible, I would say, thereby freeing most of the Palestinians from its control, I think that a kind of de facto peace is perhaps achievable. A formal peace may take a lot longer, but I think we can afford to do without that if we can have peace on the ground first.
But isn't Israel at grave danger from the West Bank, given its location, given the geography, by giving that up?
It does definitely put itself in certain dangers, yes. And I think then it will simply have to rely on its deterrent force to prevent those dangers from materializing. I mean, I think that the Palestinians will simply have to understand that, yes, they have gotten back most of the territory taken in 1967 because Israel has now left it, but that precisely because Israel has made these concessions, if Palestinian violence continues, it will be met with great force and very brutally in return, and that the Palestinians will have to draw their own conclusions as then whether such violence will be worthwhile or not.
But deterrence doesn't seem to have much effect against suicide bombers.
Well, no, it apparently doesn't have much effect on suicide bombers, but those suicide bombers are mostly coming from Palestinian towns and cities and villages that are under Israeli military occupation, in which life is very, very difficult for them. If that military occupation were to cease, I think that most of that suicide bombing would cease. And that's also a reason for our offense, mm-hmm. that it will keep out those suicide bombers who would like to continue.
Let's take a moment to reintroduce our guest for those who may have tuned in late to this program. Hillel Halkin is an Israeli journalist. He writes a weekly column for the Jerusalem Post and the New York, and a different column each week for the New York Sun. He is an author and a translator, and he's speaking here at the University of Illinois still three more times this week. And he's been brought here by Michael Shapiro's program in the program for the study of Jewish culture and society, and Michael is also in the studio with us today. Michael, would you like to tell us a little bit about your program? We've already let you be silent as we've talked about these vital world issues.
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to talk about the program. We're actually coming close to our 25th year under different titles. We've only been a program for about 7 or 8, but we are an interdisciplinary unit within the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And we don't have courses of our own, but there's some 25 or 30 courses offered in other departments and staffed by members of those departments, which roughly fit under the umbrella of Jewish studies. Some of them are in in history or anthropology or literature departments. And we also bring speakers to the university on a variety of topics. Hillel Halkin is here. Part of an Israel Studies project with help from the Jewish Federation of Metropolitan Chicago's Israel Studies project. And we are, as you suggested earlier, very interested in sending students to Israel once again. Students study Hebrew as part of our program, Modern Hebrew, and we'd like them to have the opportunity to continue those studies as students of French or Spanish can do by going to the country where that's a native language spoken daily.
Now, you're an emeritus professor in the Department of English.
Yes, yes.
And what has your specialty been?
Well, Shakespeare and Elizabethan drama primarily.
What are some of the courses – what are some of the most popular courses taught through the program for the study of Jewish culture?
We have a two-semester sequence in the history of the Jews of Europe that has been very popular. In anthropology, we've got courses on Jewish ethnography, the study of Jewish communities around the world, and another anthropology course on the American Jewish community. The anthropology and history have been quite popular, I would say. A course in the German department, German Jewish literature from Middle Ages through the Holocaust has also drawn a lot of students. Several hundred students a year pass through our courses. And we have a minor.
Well, thank you very much for being with us and for bringing our guest today, Hillel Halkin. Thank you for being here.
You're very welcome.
Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with Alicia Banks from the University-wide WCA. She'll be talking about eliminating racism and empowering women, the national mission of the YWCA in the USA. On March 12th, our guest will be on Keeping the Faith, Hassan Jabbar. He'll be talking about the life of the Prophet Muhammad for Muslims. These are a couple of the guests coming up. John Sutherland will be here talking on March 19th, and representatives of CropWalk will be here on March 26th. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and I'm the executive director of the University YMCA, where this coming Tuesday at noon, our guest will be Lauren Taylor from the University of Illinois Alumni Association. And on Friday, our guest at noon at Friday Forum will be Erica Miners, talking about the right to be hostile. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Tonight at 7 p.m. on To the Best of Our Knowledge, rebuilding's going on in New Orleans, Sri Lanka, Kashmir, and other places devastated by natural disasters. But what kind of structures are going up? Green architects and designers talk about building for the future. Also, a look at the latest spiritual design craze, Vastu, the ancient Hindu art of home design. Think of it as yoga for your house. That's To the Best of Our Knowledge coming up an hour from now here on AM 580. AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with the low in the mid-20s and southwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high in the lower 50s and southwest winds around